You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com. Hello, everybody. This is Nadira Jamal, and welcome to episode 53 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. The Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all of those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want help with the what, things like moves, combos, choreography, it's really easy to find resources. But if you want help with the why and the how, musicality, culture, business, ethics, composition, that's a little trickier to find. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a different geeky topic, and we always have time for question and answer so you can geek out too. So if you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. So tonight we're welcoming back Treasure Marshall. She's a professional performer and live event producer from Corpus Christi, Texas. She's worked in a variety of roles with the nonprofit dance company Ballet Nacional and has taught dance to children aged 3 to 7 for the past 7 years. She's also the creator of the instructional DVD, Treasure's Skirtwork for Fusion Belly Dance, and the Tips from Treasure series. You can find her at treasuremarshall.wordpress.com. So welcome, Treasure!
Hi, welcome. Excuse me. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. It's so great to have you back.
Thanks.
All right. So today, Treasure is going to talk to us about teaching children. But before we jump into our main topic, I always like to ask people about their origin story. So can you tell us about how you got started with belly dance?
Sure. When I was a little girl, I really, really loved to dance, and I would put one of those LPs on and dance around the house. And I guess my mom really noticed, and she wanted to put me in a dance class. And so she put me in tap. I think I was about 7. But what I really wanted to do was, it was the 70s and belly dance was really big. And my mom had these books. I have no idea where she'd gotten them, that were belly dance books and how to teach yourself how to belly dance. And I just was so enamored with those books. I thought that those ladies were just so glamorous and beautiful, and I wanted to do that. But there just weren't any belly dance classes for children available. But then when I was 9, that was in Phoenix, and when I was 9, we moved back to Texas, and it just came to pass that one of my grandfather's business associates, his wife was Lebanese, and she taught belly dance at the rec center. And so she didn't have kids in her group. And my mother and my grandmother went and talked to her, and they talked and talked and talked and long and hard, trying to get her to agree to take me. And finally, she did agree, and I danced with Mrs. Forrest for many years, and so that's kind of how I got started in belly dance.
And how did you get started in teaching dance to children?
Well, very, very long ago, when my daughter was young, I had no desire whatsoever to teach, not kids or adults, not at all. To me, that's kind of like dishes and laundry. It's like not a really fun job. It's just something that needs to get done. And so I wanted to put on shows. I didn't want to teach. That was, you know, not glamorous. But I was asked by the director to teach some classes, and I did for a while, but it didn't go very well, and I, very shortly thereafter, went back to him and said, look, I just don't really think I'm very good at this. I don't want to do this. I think you should find somebody else. And then, you know, fast forward years passed. And I was working in the office of the studio, and my daughter was teaching all the lower-level classes. And she left for college out of state. And we went through an entire year of these just really awful, unreliable instructors. And I felt so bad for the kids. At one point, these kids were coming in 2 times a week for classes, and there was a time where those kids did not have the same instructor 2 times a row for an entire month. And the parents were absolutely furious. And they were not furious at the instructor. They were furious at me, the administrator. And their position was, hey, you know, if the teacher cancels, then why can't you get somebody else? But that's really hard to do when you have a teacher that's calling you 20 to 30 minutes before a class is starting. So I really felt like I was between a rock and a hard place because these parents were very understandably angry. And I was dealing with this like every time I went to the studio. And finally, I went to my friend who is the president of Ballet Nacional. And I said, look, just give me the class. I'm the logical person. I'm the one that can be here early. I'm the one that can be here on Saturday mornings. Just give it to me. And she was extremely reluctant. She really, really did not want to do that. I feel pretty sure she just didn't feel that I had the temperament for it. And I said, look, I can't deal with these parents anymore. So either give me something else to do or give me the class. And so she very reluctantly gave it to me. And I think mostly because I was the only one that could be there really early. Underlying, so that was my primary reason. But underlying all of that was the fact that I was a child dancer. My daughter was a child dancer. And I felt a certain amount of responsibility because someone had done that for me to make myself available to do that for someone else. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what styles of dance do you teach?
I teach primarily folklorico and Spanish dance. Those are my my main areas. I also have to teach a lot of salsa, tropical, mishmash. It's honestly, our shows are seasonal and they're themed. And so often I have to teach other things in order to fit into the theme.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's jump into our main topic. So when we're talking about teaching kids, what age range do we really mean? Is a 17-year-old a kid in this context, or do we mean something else?
Very strictly speaking, a 17-year-old would be a kid because even kids in high school have different needs than an adult would. But really, when I say it, I mean like about preteen down.
Okay, great. And why should we consider teaching kids?
Well, there's many, many reasons, but let's talk first about the business aspects of it. If you are willing to teach children, that greatly increases the pool of possible students that you have. And if you're willing to teach very young children, that is an even greater advantage in the marketplace because the younger the child is, the more likely it is that the family is actively looking for something for the child to do, and there's fewer options available to them. So when they're three, there's just not a lot, but when they're, you know, six, seven, eight, on up from there, then there's music lessons, there's karate, there's sports, there's other things available. So if you bring them into your studio when they're really, really young, then by the time they are old enough to have those other things even available to them, then they've already been dancing with you for several years, and they're much less likely to leave and go try other things. They're more likely to stick with you in the long term. And the other thing is that when you have really, really young kids, very often this is their first activity outside of school. In other words, if you have a three-year-old, then they're probably only ever done daycare or something of that nature. Even seven-year-olds, they don't have a lot of after-school activities for the 3 to 7 age range. So those parents come in and they're really excited. They are really very excited with the idea of here is this fun thing that my kid's going to get to do. And it's not just the parents, it's also the extended family. You know, grandma and grandpa are excited, and aunt and uncle are excited. Everybody's really, really excited because this is the first thing that the child's ever really gotten to do. And so they are much more willing to pitch in. And that can mean that maybe grandparents help with tuition, or maybe aunt or uncle drops off or sees to it that the child is not going to be late to class. Everybody really kind of cooperates, and that makes it a much easier sell. It's much easier to get people to enroll.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about the business end. What are the other angles on that that you think make it a good idea for us to start teaching kids?
Well, it can be really, really rewarding, and it can be a headache just like anything else, but you get really attached to the kids. You get to know the families. It becomes very, very much a family atmosphere, and honestly, you get a lot of extended families. When you start taking kids, then you start getting, maybe mom wants to try it, or lots and lots of cousins. The whole family really starts to get interested and get involved. And so again, that's more the business aspect of it. But there is a lot of intangibles that the kids get from it. And there are things like learning how to take directions from somebody outside of the family. Things like being confident and confident that they can go up there on stage by themselves. You know, even now every studio is different, but where we teach, teachers do not go on stage with the kids. The kids go up there by themselves. And that really gives them a lot of inner strength, I think. And there's just so many aspects of it that you don't really realize that you're teaching until you recognize it developing in the child.
Mm-hmm. And how does what they learn change as they grow older? Like how do they benefit at different stages of their lives?
Well, I think when they're really young, it's a lot about following directions and socialization and learning to be away from mom and dad, because some kids have, you know, they've never been in daycare, or they've never been away from their family. So this is the first time they've ever kind of been separated. So there's that part of it. Then when they get to be a little older, maybe 5 or 6, they start, you know, kind of saying, hey, you know, I'm pretty good at this. And that builds this certain level of confidence. And I see that bleed over into other areas of their lives. And I think then when you get to the preteen level, that is a very tricky time of life for kids. They get really angry sometimes. They get very mouthy, and they kind of don't see the point of anything. So that's a really, really difficult age. And if you can kind of help groom them into being a good person and being a responsible person, it's kind of, you know, train up a child in the way that they should go, and when they're old, they will not depart from it. And this is your chance to be a part of kind of training up that child and helping them to mature and to be responsible.
Mm-hmm. All right. And, you know, when we start thinking about including classes for children, how much of an age range can you fit into a single class?
Well, ideally, 2 to 3 years apart is the best. That is, you know, the best case scenario. Sometimes you do have to put kids in a bigger range together. And that's a little bit trickier. I did have a period of time where I had to have everything from 3 to 7 all in one group, because we just didn't have enough kids to make 2 separate groups. And there's a really, really large even in the lower levels, even developmentally, the difference between a child who has just turned three and a child that's about to turn four, there's a huge difference in what those kids can do. So when you look at it at that level, when you've got three-year-olds mixed with seven-year-olds, that's really difficult. And what I ended up having to do was making it at a kind of a middle-of-the-road level where it was actually a little bit too difficult for the younger kids to master, and a little bit watered down for the older kids. But it was fine for a while until we had the numbers that we needed to split the group.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that you said 2 to 3 years, because I went to a public Montessori school that started in pre-K and went to eighth grade, but all of our classes were in groups of 3 years. So we had the 3 to 5s, 5s to 7s, 7 to 9s, and 9 to 11s, and 11 to 13s. And that kind of gave everybody a way to, because we weren't just first grade separate from second grade, you know, the folks who were moving a little faster versus the ones who were moving a little bit more slowly could always be accommodated and still be in an age-appropriate group. So that's really interesting to me, because I've never seen that in any other context.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point. I homeschooled my daughter, and we often did things like there were homeschool art groups and things like that that she could go and attend with other homeschoolers. And what was very interesting to me is, as you said, they were, you know, there was a mixed age range, but there wasn't a huge gap. So I would say there were probably at most there was maybe 4 years difference in those little groups and classes that she would attend. And it was really great because you saw the older kids helping and interacting with the younger kids, and they were really very kind to each other. And I think that having them in a group where they are not strictly all of one age is super beneficial developmentally.
Cool. All right. So let's say that you do have, level ranges for mm-hmm. your children's classes. So let's say you do have a 3 to 5, a 5 to 7, and a 7 to 9 group. What if you have an older kid who wants to start dancing with no experience? So let's say, you know, you have a 7-year-old who's never danced before, but most of the other 7-year-olds have been with you for 4 years. How would you go about placing that kid?
Okay, what I would do, when you get really, really large, you'll have beginner, intermediate, advanced at different levels as well. But if you just have one 7-year-old class, or, you know, one 3 to 5, one 5 to 7, or whatever, and you have a 7-year-old come in off the street, then I go ahead and what I do is we put them with the 7-year-olds. But personally, what I discovered when I did that was that there are skills that they learn in the lower level classes that you don't realize that you're teaching until you get a child like that who's older and who's coming in with no dance experience. And the way that I remedied that, and I do this for multiple reasons, but one of the reasons that the thing that I do is to insist that those children that are in that group, they must know not only all of their own dances from that level, but they also have to learn all of the dances from the level below them. And I really, really hit hard on that when I realized that, hey, I was teaching things in that lower level class that I didn't really know that I was teaching. And then I get this child and she doesn't do that intuitively because she wasn't in that lower level class. And so I realized by being sure that they know all of those dances, then you are better able to cover all of those skills and get that child prepared to go on to an even more advanced class.
And when you're referring to a dance here, do you mean a style of dance, or are you talking about a specific choreography that group learned?
Specific choreographies. We have repertoires. Mm-hmm. And so each group has a certain number of dances, and we add to that and delete it very frequently. But there is always a certain number of dances that that both, say, the 3 to 5s and the 5 to 7s know, and they're core dances. And that way, you, if, for instance, let's say another reason for doing that, besides the whole skills thing, another reason for doing that is, let's say you have a performance coming up, but there's not enough kids from any one group that can make the performance. If they have common choreographies, then you can take, you know, two from this group and three from that group and put them together, and you don't have to miss the performance opportunity. You have something, and because it's a dance that's in your repertoire, it's, you know, it's quick to polish up. You might need to polish it a little bit, but they basically already know that core dance. So when I was talking about that, I was specifically talking about choreography.
Gotcha. All right. Now, this is a little bit different from the scenario that we're talking about, but maybe most relevant to the folks who are already teaching adults. When is a child old enough, or how can you tell if they're mature enough to join an adult class if you don't have a kids class yet?
Well, I definitely would think that I was 9, and when I went into my first teacher's group, and I think that that's definitely a really good age. If you had a more mature 7 or 8 year old, and the class was open to it, in other words, if you weren't getting pushback from the adults, then, it, of course, it's going to depend on the child. But a 7 or 8 year old might be able to do it as well. I think definitely by 9. But any time you were bringing in a child to an adult group, I would definitely have a conversation with the parent, just like my first teacher did with my parents, and let them know that if it's not working or the child is disruptive, that they're not going to be allowed to stay.
Mm-hmm. And are there any particular qualities that you should look for in judging whether they're ready to be in a pool with adults?
I don't think you're going to know that, because I think in a scenario like that, you're probably going to be taking somebody in, I say off the street, you know, somebody you don't know. Am I getting the scenario right? You have somebody come in and they want to put their child in class, but there's no children's class.
Right.
I don't think you're going to be able to tell that other than just to talk to the parents and say, hey, you know, this is really an adult group, and I'm happy to give it a shot. Do you think that your child's mature enough to do this? And be open. Just be, I think, if you're very the tone that you take is important. You know, if you say all that in a friendly way, parents are going to be, they're going to be pretty open about it. You know, they don't want their kid to get kicked out of class.
Right. You know, you can approach it with a feeling of, you know, we all want your child to have the best possible experience.
Definitely. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is often the key for many, many different scenarios. If you take a tone of kind of loving concern, you're going to get so much farther and have much more better communication than if you it's just really, really important that that's kind of the way you present yourself of, hey, you know, I want what's best for your kid, just like you do.
Mm-hmm. Nice. All right. So if we start getting into, you know, some of the more logistical questions, how do you get started with a kid's class? Where how should you begin?
Well, I think if you didn't have any kids at all, I really think that your number one place to start, because we've started groups like this when we needed a Saturday group, or we needed a group that was a specific age. Your number one go-to is going to be your friends, family, and students that have young children. That is the very first place to start. And many times, if you just go to those people and say, hey, you know, I'm interested in starting a kids group. Would you like to put your child in? And do you know people that would want to join? That sometimes that's just that alone is enough. Those people will either put their children in, or they will let their friends know that are actively looking for activities for their kids. And they can sometimes put the group together for you right there. On occasion, you may have to kind of sweeten the deal for them a little bit. For instance, we often will offer to waive the registration fee for anybody that's willing to join the group. I don't know what else you might do. That's the easy thing for us to just go, hey, you know, we'll waive all the registration fees, and if the just make it really easy for them to say yes. And then you'll have your group, and then once you have your group formed, it's just really easy once that's in place to get people to sign up, because they're actively looking for things for their kids to do.
Mm-hmm. It seems like word of mouth is even a bigger thing when it comes to kids' activities than adults, because, you know, the parents, depending on the status of their own friendships, are in a lot of cases talk mostly about what their kids are doing.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah. You know, if you've got a play date, you know, that might be half the conversation is, oh, what does she do on Saturdays?
Yeah, exactly. And then, yes, that's very, very true. And especially if these are your friends, family, and students, they're going to be quick to recommend you because they already know you. So that's your number one go-to starting point. Besides that, there's some other things that you can think about doing. Schools and libraries are really good resources, libraries in particular. Children's librarians are often looking for, they need a monthly program that they present, and it's hard for them to find people who will do those little programs. And so if you contact the children's librarian, particularly if it's a library that's close by where you're going to be teaching, we happen to have a library right across the street, and that has really benefited us. So you can call that librarian up and say, hey, you know, would you be interested in me putting on some kind of a children's presentation? And lots of times they'll jump on it. But then you need to deal with the scheduling of it, and that can be a little bit more tricky. You may have to find a way to work yourself into one of their themes. For instance, last summer when I contacted our children's librarian, she said, oh, you know what? Month after next, our theme is, I think it was get up and move or something like that. It had something to do with getting up and moving and exercising and getting outside of the house. And she went, that would just be perfect. And so would you do something for that? So that was great. So as long as they understand that you are going to want to hand out like flyers or some kind of information like that, I haven't ever had anybody have a problem with that. They're always happy to have us. And so then you can put together a little program. The more you can find ways for the kids to interact, the better. So maybe you come out and do a little talk, and then you ask them questions. They love to, you know, say, hey, you know, raise their hand and answer questions. They really, really like that. If you can find a way, the last time we did one, we had two different times when the kids got up and danced with us. That's a really, really great thing. At the end, we had a conga line, and I lined the kids up by height, and we did a little line around the room, and we would stop periodically, and I'd say, okay, somebody do a move, and we're gonna all copy you. And those kids were just having a blast, and the parents were cheering, and it went really, really great. And we had a lot of inquiries after that. So that's kind of another resource. Another thing that you can do, but this gets a lot stickier, is that you can contact your school district. And if you can find a way to have something that's educational, for instance, we have a Festival of the Arts that's in the fall, that's a citywide program. And during that time, a lot of the dance studios open their doors and they invite people in to observe the classes and that sort of thing. And they have, you know, refreshments. And it's just a way for people to get more interested in the arts, make it really open and available to them. And so what we would do is invite people in, and we would have maybe a little, sometimes they would just come and observe classes, but we would have like a little educational program about dance. And if you can put something together like that, then you can contact the school and say, I have this educational thing. Can I have permission to give flyers to these particular schools and have them distribute them to the teachers' boxes? And you'd have to get approval for that, and you have to jump through a lot of hoops. But if you can get approval, then you package up your flyers and like you count out certain numbers and group them together, and then you can deliver them to the schools, and the offices will put those flyers in the teachers' boxes, and then the teachers give them out to the kids.
Nice. This is all brilliant, like brilliant. The other thing
I was taught by a master. Most of this is not my idea.
And, you know, I don't know if this is true for anybody else, but in my adult classes, I found I have a pretty high percentage of teachers. I wonder if that's even, if that's true for other people, that might also be a good way to start, you know, getting a feeler for getting into those kinds of opportunities is the people who are already studying with you and understand what you have to offer.
Oh, for sure. Let me tell you something else that happened. We had one of our dancers, one of our adult dancers, was a Spanish teacher at the high school, one of the high schools here. And this was kind of her idea. She said, hey, you know, we had two really big shows a year, and it was important to sell the tickets because we had to pay for the theater. It was very expensive. And she said, hey, you know, I will give my kids extra credit in their Spanish class if they will come and attend these performances. Because our shows were usually had to do with Hispanic culture. So she was the one that started that. And there ever after, we would call all of the high schools and ask to speak with the Spanish teachers and say, would you be willing to offer your kids extra credit if they would attend our shows? And they almost always said yes. So that's not only a way to get people into your show, but some of those high school kids, they might be interested in dancing.
Mm-hmm. That's a great idea. And I'm thinking about, you know, folks who are doing belly dance only. I'm thinking, especially if you know folkloric dances, that could even be another in, you know, you teach line
definitely.
Dance, you teach chalai, whatever it is. That can be a really good, especially if you're making the case for this as a cultural activity rather than an artistic activity specifically.
Right.
Really focusing on folk dance could be a great in.
That's definitely right. And I will tell you that, there are, if you teach folk dance like I do, and as people who teach belly dance do, there are definitely people who come to you very specifically saying that they want their kids to learn more about their culture. And so I do want to say that if you teach folk dance and what you teach is not traditional, then just be sure that when the parents come in and talk to you, that you let them know right up front that what you do is not traditional. And I don't think I've ever had a parent yet that was like, oh, well, no, if it's not traditional, I don't want my child in this. They really don't care. They just want them to be exposed to it. But it's always best to let them know if it's not traditional.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Now, you know, when we're thinking about teaching kids, about how long would the ideal class time be? What's their attention span?
Well, when my daughter started, 3 to 5s were a 45-minute classes, and everything above that was an hour. And we have played with that a little bit. We have had classes as short as 30 minutes, and we have had 3 to 5s, you know, take an hour class. And there's a lot of benefit to having a 45-minute class. I don't recommend a 30-minute class. that really doesn't give you enough time to get very much done. Also, if anybody's late, you know, even if they're only a few minutes late, they've missed a lot. So I don't recommend 30-minute classes. But if you are in a position where you could do a 45-minute class for your babies, there are benefits to that. One of them would be that you can lower the price a little bit, which makes it a little more attractive to the parents, particularly if they have more than one child, because, you know, it all costs money. And so if they're 45 minutes, you can charge a little less. And it's easier on you as the instructor because you are not trying to hold that child's attention for just an extra 15 minutes. And I will say that when we change those classes from 45 minutes to an hour, those kids that were used to that 45-minute class, they had this internal clock, and they knew when it 45 minutes had passed. And they would start getting kind of whiny, and we eventually, you know, were able to train them into the one-hour class. But those kids, they know how long it's been, and they do start, you know, there toward the end, they start to get restless.
And what's an ideal class size when you're teaching kids? How many is too many, or is there a class that's too small?
Yes. I would say that ideal is 6 to 8. If you have 6 kids, that's a really nice full class. If you have 8, that's super full, but it's manageable. When you start getting over 8 kids, even just one more kid, it starts to get kind of cumbersome. It's hard to keep your eyes on everybody. And it would be better at that point to either break it up into 2 classes or to get like an assistant, somebody who can help you just keep them rounded up, keep eyes on, you know, be sure nobody's, you know, doing anything crazy like hanging from the ballet bars. I would definitely say. And then on the 2 small spectrum, the smaller the group gets, the more difficult it is to teach. And when you get to where you've only got 1 or 2 kids, which I did have for a really, really long time, that is super difficult, because when you have at least 3, you know, when you have at least 3 or 4 kids, then you can teach them things like spacing, you can teach them partnering, you can teach them timing. Just there's so many things that you can teach that you just can't do when there's only 1 or even 2. It's possible to teach a class with just 1 or 2 kids, but man, you are going to have to work really, really hard. And so I would definitely be, you know, trying that whole time to get more kids in there.
All right. Well, we've talked a little bit about, you know, keeping the class on track and when you need an assistant, but just in general, you know, how do you help kids get focused when the class starts?
I think the key to that is to have kind of a routine. And I am very anti-structure. I'm not a structured person at all. But especially when they first come in, if they have a little routine and they know what to expect, that really helps them settle into the class. Like when they come into my class, the first 15 minutes, I do stretching and strengthening exercises, balance, a lot of focus on balancing. And those, 15 minutes, they know I do the exercises in a certain order. They know when they come in, they're supposed to line up in their lineup. I mean, even my 3-year-olds have a lineup, and they know where their space is, where they're supposed to be. So they come in, they get in their lineup, we start the exercises, we do them in a certain order, unless I forget, which happens on occasion, and they always correct me. That really kind of helps them settle in. It helps them to get focused. And that is another reason why I fuss at my parents that are late all the time, because when they come in late, not only are they not getting the benefit of that, but they're also kind of disrupting the other kids from focusing.
And how do you manage distractions during the class? So what kinds of things tend to distract kids, and how can you get them back on track when things go awry?
The number one distraction is parents. That is by far and away the number one thing that diverts their attention. And it's not necessarily that the parents are trying to be, you know, pushy or anything like that. They just are distracted that their parent, that any parent, it doesn't even have to be their own, is in the room. And so for that reason, where I teach, the parents are not allowed in the room. If we have a new kid, like a kid that's coming in to try the class, the parent is allowed in for the first 15 minutes or the last 15 minutes. If they're shy, I always suggest the first 15 minutes, even though that part of the class is kind of boring. Mm-hmm. But if the child is real confident, then they'll come in for the last 15 minutes. And when those parents come in, even my kids that have been with me for a long time, they can get distracted just that there's somebody else in the room. So that is the biggest distraction. The other thing that's a big, big distraction is viewing windows. And there is a viewing window where I teach, but it is covered by a semi-opaque curtain. So parents can hear what's happening, and they can see movement and shadows, but the curtain kind of keeps the kids from rushing over there and waving and all that kind of nonsense. So that's, you know, that's a big, big distraction. But if the curtain, if you have a curtain or something, that cuts it really down to the bone. Then occasionally you may have a kid that just cannot stop touching the curtain. They just can't seem to stop looking out. And I will, you know, always call the kid out and say, you know, that is not allowed. And you just can't do that. And if you keep doing it, then I'm going to have to cover the window. And we have a piece of foam board that we will put in the window temporarily if we have a child that just cannot seem to keep their hands off the curtain. Mm-hmm. Besides that, I would say down the scale then is kids that are either there's a personality conflict and they can't seem to get along, or kids that just are so in love with each other that they can't stop hugging and talking, and that's a different kind of distraction. And for something like that, it's always best to just change your lineup. And if you have a situation where if you change the lineup and you either have two kids that love each other or two kids that just can't get along, pick the two kids that love each other. It's just a better scenario than having to stop your class because you have two four-year-olds that are squared off and they're ready to duke it out. that's really distracting for everybody. So it's always better, you know, if you have to pick a situation where you got two kids that just can't stop talking.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, what kind of tactics can you use to get everybody behaving properly and focused again when you do have a disruption?
Well, I'm really strict. I think that's one of the reasons why my friend was very hesitant to put me in a teaching role, because I'm really quick to call them out. I'm very quick to, I don't like a lot of fooling around. And that's not to say that we don't have fun. We do. We have fun. But I just, we're there to work. And I really kind of try to impress that on the kids. Look, you know, I've told kids before, you're very, very lucky to be able to dance. There's lots of kids that can't dance. So we need to be sure that we take advantage and we work while we're here. So I call them out. If you have a kid that's not enough, then another thing that I will do is have the child sit in timeout for a while. Not very long, not a long time. I usually say one to two songs, which where I teach is about 3 to 6 minutes. So that's something else that you can do. And once they've been, especially when they're real little, Once they have been sitting it out for 3 or 6 minutes, they're usually, you know, they're settled down and they're ready to rejoin the class. So that's another thing that I do to kind of keep things lined up. But really, I think it's a lot of just going, hey, you know, what's going on? We're supposed to be dancing here, you know, and just keep on them in that way. And they get the idea. It's really about grooming and training, and they will definitely eventually know what's expected of them.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, this is maybe a little bit of a side note here, but when you teach multiple classes for kids, how can you tell when it's time to move a child up a level? Do you recommend just going by time served or by a specific set of skills that they've achieved?
Well, no, I don't, let's see, let me think that over. What usually happens is one child is going to, they're going to be obviously much better dancers than the other kids. And first, it's only going to be obvious to you, but eventually it's going to be obvious to the parents as well. And parents don't like that. They don't like one kid that's much better than the other kids because they feel like their kid's getting shown up. And so when you get to that stage, that's when it's time to move them. That's why it's a really good idea to have some overlap between your classes, because if you strictly say this class is for 3-year-olds, this class is for 5-year-olds, this class is, you know, and you're very rigid in the age grouping, then you don't have the flexibility to move a kid. Like, let's say your class is 5 to 7 and you have a 7-year-old that's way doing much, much better, and you know you need to bump them up. Well, if the next group has a little bit of an overlap, then it's real easy to move them up. Whereas if you are strictly adhering to age level or time served, then you might be moving up kids that aren't ready, or you may have a scenario where you've definitely got a kid that's not ready, and the parent's coming to you going, hey, you know, it's time for my kid to graduate. So I definitely think you're going to know based on the child's ability, because they're gonna be really, really doing much, much better in performance than the other kids.
Well, speaking of parents, yeah, how do you deal with parents who might be, you know, pushy or coaching from the sidelines?
That can be an issue. I think probably less so where I teach, because we don't have parents in the classroom. But that can, regardless, that's still an issue sometimes. And I think the very best thing to do is you want to kind of take the parent aside. Like, if they have, parents are pretty quick to let you know when they're not happy. In general. And even if they don't say anything, a lot of times you'll walk into the room and you see a lot of angry faces. And, you know, that's kind of the time to say, hey, you know, does anybody have any questions, or is there anything anybody needs to talk to me about? And that's their invitation to kind of, you know, and then if they approach you, then you want to kind of separate yourself from everybody else so that you can talk freely. And then, we're back to that tone and loving concern thing. So if you are talking to a parent and they are pushing, like, you know, they want their kid moved up, or they don't like something about what you're doing, or they're pushing you in some way, then try to show them with your, not just your words, but with your body language and your tone, that you're really interested and concerned about what they're saying, and that you really want to resolve the problem, even if it's something there's nothing that you can do about. If you approach it with that kind of tone, they're going to be a lot more receptive to what you're saying. My friend says that nodding your head yes, like, yes, I understand, is going to get you a whole lot farther than shaking your head no, like, no, I'm not going to do it. So, and she's absolutely right about that. But and sometimes sometimes it is something you really can't do anything about. But either way, try to be as transparent with the parent as you can. For instance, if it's the child's not ready to be moved up, let's say, just for an example, then you can say, you know, I can understand what you're saying or what your concerns are, but here's the reason why I think that your child isn't ready. And as long as you can be diplomatic with your words, then just, you know, be really transparent. And again, back to, hey, you know, we both want what's best for this child. They're generally pretty receptive to that.
All right. So, and a related question, whether it's a problem or even just laying the groundwork for a good relationship, what should a teacher do to make sure that the parents are comfortable and satisfied? Because it seems like in this situation, they're the real customer, not the child.
Yeah, in many ways, that's true. I think the key to that is having really open communications with your parents. Just being friendly with them. And, ask them not just about the kid, you know, and you get to know them. How what's going on? Did you get that job you were applying for? Or, I know that your husband was not feeling well. How's he doing? You know, just really when they feel that you're somebody that they can talk to, that's going to go a whole long way toward resolving conflicts before they ever really arise. So I think just, you know, being really, really open with people, I mean, as much as you can. Of course, you don't want to be, I know there's a certain amount of, you don't want somebody to take advantage of you. And I understand, but just try to be as open as you can be. Parents are terrible gossips. They really are. And so when you start like hearing little things, and maybe that mom that really, really likes you might even come to you and tell you something that's happening or something that's being said, or you come in, this is something that happens. I'll come into the waiting area and there's a bunch of really angry faces. You know, that's when you go, hey, you know, did anybody need anything? Is everything going okay? And most of the time, if they're going to say something, they'll say something then.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And, we've already talked about the tone, but how do you decide when it's time to bring up a behavior issue with parents rather than dealing with it in the class?
Well, I have, I guess, a rule for myself. I handle as many behavior issues in the classroom as I possibly can for a number of reasons. If you're constantly going to the parents, complaining about their behavior, the parents are embarrassed, they're upset, you know, they are going to start thinking about maybe this isn't the best thing for their kid. Or alternately, they may act like, you know, hey, this is your problem for the hour that you have them in class. Are you not able to handle this? So I try to, and I don't want some child to get in serious trouble with their parents over some minor infraction. So I try to handle everything that I possibly can in the classroom. I don't go to a parent unless I have a child that is being so disruptive that it's become a problem. I will always, approach the parent privately and say, hey, you know, can I talk to you about something? And this is what's happening in class, and that's a problem because of X, Y, Z. What do you think? What do you think that we should do? Because very often, by the time you get to that point, the parents are aware that there's a problem. And the child may be having that same problem at school or at home in different, you know, parts of their lives. And a lot of times they have already kind of developed a strategy to address that. And so there's times where you'll be able to use that strategy with the child in the classroom, or there may, if it's something that you can't really implement at that time, then you can say, hey, do I need to talk to mom about this, or dad, you know, whoever it is that's in charge, do I need to talk to mom and dad about what you're doing here? Because they're going to, you know, implement this strategy with you, you know, and that, that is a, again, for most kids, that's going to be enough. I've only been in one scenario where I had a child that was just so incredibly disruptive that I was just at my wit's end to know what to do. She had developmental problems. She had behavior issues. She just had so many problems that there was, I mean, it was a constant issue. And I talked to the mother many, many times. And there just came this class where she was screaming and crying and carry on. We just having a fit. I was in distress. All the other kids were in distress. And I, at the end of the class, I just decided this cannot ever happen again. And so at that time, I talked to the mom and I said, look, this is just a real, real big problem. And so if she won't listen, and this is a child who was, I treat things differently. If a child is misbehaving because they're being mischievous, right or wrong, I don't think that's as serious as a child that is openly defiant. You know, that is just something that cannot happen. And so, you know, I explained to the mom that she, you know, she was deliberately defying me and that this was just getting to a critical mass situation. And that if she, if I kept having problems, that what I was going to do is I was going to send her out for the rest of the class, and that she could come back next week, you know, because I taught her once a week. She had a different instructor the other day, and she was welcome to come back to my next class, and I would be welcome her back with open arms. But if the behavior started again, I was going to send her out again. And the first time I had to implement that, oh my gosh, the screaming and the crying and the, you know, and they, I thought mom would take her home and she didn't. They kind of waited around for me to come out. And I just explained to her, you know, sweetie, you just can't act like that. You just can't act like that in here. And you can always come back to my class. I'll always give you another chance. But for today, you're going to have to go home. And she never did it again. And I'm not going to say that I never had problems with that child again, but it never got to that level again. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, wrapping up our section on parents, you know, it seems like most parents have this idea that, well, of course my daughter is going to dance, but usually that means ballet or tap or jazz. And, you know, even these days, I think hip hop is a pretty common choice for little kids too.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. How do you get them on board with the idea of learning other dances, and in particular belly dance, where it would, some people sometimes have this sexualized idea of it?
Yeah. So let me tell you my thoughts about that. I think that particularly with belly dance, the way you present yourself is going to be really, really important. And the way you frame things up is going to be also very, very important. So I got to thinking about that. And, you know, when I first started and I was a little girl, my teacher and all of her students, we wore leotards. And the women, I didn't, but the women wore hosiery of some sort. So there was no bare midriffs and all that kind of stuff until performance. That just wasn't allowed. And I think that presents kind of a more conservative picture. And I think that is going to be, again, make it easier for you to convince people. Another thing is if belly dance, if those words are the problem, if that's like a trigger in the community where you live, then don't call it that. Call it Middle Eastern phobia. You know, that's what it is. And I'm afraid that some people are going to say, well, that's a cop-out. But I personally don't see a problem with using language that causes people to see it in a different way. And I really, really like that word folk dance because to me that evokes community, inclusion, wholesomeness, and a lot of things that we, you know, we say we want to promote. So I think that very much a lot of those things are all that, you know, kind of, oh my gosh, I would never let my child do that. I think that kind of, it will go away if you frame it up in a different context.
I have this thought in my head too, and I don't know if this is a good idea or a bad idea, so I'd love to get your input on it.
Okay.
Is that, you know, so much of the dance world, for all the wonderful things that it can teach children, it can also give them tremendous body image problems. And I wonder so an awful lot of that is the pressure to have a certain body type, the pressure to make your body conform to that type. And also, you know, I know an awful lot of people who were very seriously into ballet who were just told at, you know, 12 or 13 or 14, you have no future as a dancer because they didn't look right or they developed differently. And
right.
I wonder,
and go ahead.
And so I'm wondering, you know, is when you're speaking to the child of a 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 year old, is it too early to sell the point that, you know, this is a dance that they'll be able to do their entire life? Nobody's ever going to tell them you can't be a dancer.
Well, I would never have thought of that. That's not where I thought you were going with that. Yes, I think that that is an excellent selling point, a very, very excellent selling point. I definitely would say that to a parent without a second thought. Now, as far as I know that, as you say, in the belly dance world, there's a lot of emphasis on wanting to give people healthy feelings about body image. And I think that I don't see that a lot. I don't see the issue as much here. And I'm not super clear if that's just because I've always been involved in some sort of folk dance as opposed to ballet, or if it's just kind of part of the social structure of where I live. Usually when I have someone who has tells me that their child has an issue with body image, and it's almost always mom. It's almost always mom. I don't hear this from the kids, and I don't see the kids saying ugly things to each other. So this is coming from somewhere outside. Usually, honestly, it's not often about, oh, you're too fat or whatever. It's things like a girl that has, like, maybe she's very dark complected or she has a lot of body hair or it's things like that rather than the typical you're too fat or you have boobs and you're a ballerina. You know, that kind of stuff I don't see as much. But I would say that anytime, I'm mentioning this because I know that this is a big issue in the belly dance community. If you are wanting to promote positive body imagery, then and positive feelings about their bodies, especially with young kids, you really, really need to look to your costuming. You know, if you have one girl that's taller and heavier, you know, you want to be sure that your costumes are going to be flattering on everybody. And you also, oh, for crying out loud, and this is not a belly dance issue. I see this in literally every dance form, including dance forms I didn't even think you could do this in. And that is please do not send a child out on stage in a skimpy, sexy, suggestive costume. That is going to hurt their body image more than anything else I can possibly think of. So I think that if you you want to promote that in kids especially, that you really, really need to take a really hard look at your costume.
All right. Well, that's actually a great segue into my next section on kind of class content, what we teach. When you're teaching children, how can you make sure that the stuff that you're teaching them is appropriate for their age?
Okay. Well, I think that, you know, of course you have to worry about, is the step too hard or too, you know, that of course you have to worry about. So you have to worry about, is the step age appropriate? But oftentimes I think the things that make a dance not appropriate is music. Don't pick a music that has an adult theme. I mean, I've just cringed when I would go to these events and there's little, you know, 4 and 5 year olds and they're dancing to Whose Bed Have Your Boots Been Under? That's not appropriate for a little baby. Don't pick music that has an adult theme. Don't pick music that has foul language or suggestive language. So I think that the starting point is going to be picking age-appropriate music. And that doesn't mean you have to use kids' music, but, you know, let's be sure that it's not something that's going to make grandma cringe. And that is a really, really good a litmus test is if this little child was doing this in front of grandma or even the teen. Where I get this idea is from a teenage dancer that she performed one of our choreographies at a family event. And she told me, you know, when we do that part where we kind of crawl on the floor, I really didn't feel comfortable doing that in front of my grandma. And so, you know, let's think of it like that. Is this step or music or whatever we're discussing, is that something that would make grandma cringe? and the same, you know, with so the music is your starting point, then the styling of the steps, because you can do the same step in one style and it looks like no big deal, and you do this a step with a more suggestive kind of a body movement, and it looks, ooh, that's sexy. We don't want that. So styling is another really, really big point. Did I answer all that question? I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, on a related note, how much complexity can you throw at kids versus at adults?
For kids, you need to water it down a lot. I mean, a lot. Take it down to the lowest possible level that you can think of, and then see if you can think of a way to make it even easier than that. You need to, and then when you go in the classroom, try it on. Think about, like, if you were feeding a little baby or a little kitten or something like that. Give them a tiny little bite and see how they do. And if they do well, great. You know, then you can give them something a little more, you know, either on the fly, you know, if you're good at kind of teaching on the fly, you can do it right then. Or if you're not good at that, then just go, oh, you know, at the end of that class, well, that didn't work, and scrap it. And the next time you can come in and give them something either way. You know, let's say it turned out it was too hard. Well, you can make it easier. Or vice versa. If they gobbled it down and they wanted more, well, then next time you can make something a little more complicated.
So, go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm not sure I answered your whole question.
Oh, absolutely. All right. And when you're thinking about, you know, what you want to accomplish over an entire class semester, are there different skills that you would emphasize for kids versus adults?
Yeah, I think that with kids, you have no choice except, especially starting with young ones and working your way up, you really don't have a lot of options step to focus on teaching concepts over steps. When you're teaching kids, you have to worry much more about teaching concepts like make a straight line, follow the leader, skip in a circle, those kinds of concepts, because they're not able to do very much. When I first started, that's really a lot of the reason why it didn't go well with me when my daughter was little and I taught, was I thought if my kid could do it, then any kid could do it. And that was a big mistake. So you want to kind of keep it really, really, really basic and focus on ideas and make your choreographies super, super simple and repetitive. And then as they get a little older, you can give them maybe one more step. Like maybe if most of your choreographies have three steps, then give them four steps, but make the steps a little more difficult. Teach more complicated concepts, like more complicated formations, and things like maybe they enter from both sides of the room instead of all from the same side, or one part of the group enters at a different time in the music, or they're doing different steps at different times. In other words, maybe the front row is doing one step and the back row is doing something different. So think about concepts over steps and choreography.
All right. Well, the next thing I'd like to talk about are some of the, you know, practical issues when it comes to teaching kids versus adults. So, you know, are there any special legal considerations that you need to take into account when you're teaching minors?
There's a few things. Now, I'm not a lawyer and I can't give legal advice, but there are some things that I think maybe people might not think about. The first thing I would say is regarding insurance. Check and see what kind of coverage you have that you might get from the studio that you're teaching at. They may have some kind of a big umbrella policy that covers all of their instructors. If you don't have that, then you might want to look into getting teachers insurance. I think it's called dance teachers insurance. If you Google that, you will find companies that sell dance teachers insurance. That would be for things like somebody fell and got hurt in your class. It's very affordable. I think it's somewhere around $100 a year. So you might want to think about that. I think the thing that I think really, really gets overlooked that's super, super important is that in our culture today, where everybody's got a phone in their pocket, you need to worry a lot about photography and videography. In the last 8 years, I guess, we have added a phrase to the paperwork that says that they give their permission for their child's pictures and videos to be taken and used. And if the parent will not agree, then the child is not allowed to perform because people, it's just really ingrained in our culture right now, and people don't really think about the fact that, let me give you an example. Maybe 2 years ago, I had a couple of instances back-to-back where I had some parents in the room because I had kids that were trying the class out to see if they, you know, wanted to go into it. And I'm busy with the class, and I look over, and the parents are videotaping. And there was no maliciousness, but they never entered their head that this is a room full of underage children, and, you know, maybe their parents don't want some stranger taking pictures of them and possibly posting them on the web. Fortunately, we had already put that in the paperwork, so I knew, you know, we were okay. And then, like another time, I walked into the waiting area, and there were a couple of parents that had their cameras up to the crack in the curtain in the window. So there's absolutely no way that you are going to be able to stop every instance of a child's picture being taken. So it would probably be really, really wise to get permission for that.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And then just in terms of, you know, more of the day-to-day operations, you know, is there anything that we need to think about? I know you mentioned, you know, getting other family members to help with pickups and drop-offs. You know, what kind of considerations like that do we have to take into account?
Do you mean like safety issues?
Oh, you know, just off the top of my head, you know, how is payment different, or making sure that the child has somebody picking them up, or what do you do if that person doesn't show?
Yeah, that's happened a couple of times, not very often. Payment is not really different. It is a little bit different. It's hard for me to know because I've dealt more with kids than adults. You do have people who are slow to pay, but when that happens, I guess I don't know if that happens any more often with kids than adults. But the first thing I do is I will put a note on the door in magic marker that's really bold that says payment is due first of the month and late payments start on the 10th. And that's a hint, because that sign is not on the door all the time. So that grabs their attention, and hopefully you won't have to do anything more than that. Another thing that you might need to do is to kind of go in and say, hey, you know, it's after the 10th of the month, has everybody paid their tuition? And if you have somebody that has gotten behind, then, you know, talk to them privately and say, hey, you know, let's figure out a way for you to catch them up. We really need to get this under control and figure out some kind of a payment plan for them. The lastly thing that you have kind of to hold up over people's heads to get that to happen is that you can put in place a rule, as we have, that kids cannot perform unless we reserve this for like recitals. If it's some little nursing home thing, not so much. But if there's a recital or there's a big show, we let people know, and we'll go tell the whole room, you know, so that nobody feels singled out. Hey, you know, remember, your child's not going to be allowed to perform if you haven't caught up on your payments. And that can mean for us, that not just means tuition, but also we have mandatory fundraising because we're nonprofit. So they have to have met all their fundraising obligations. And that's, you know, that's kind of about all you can do. You know, that's really other than that. So I think that's everything that I can suggest as far as payment.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Sure. Yeah.
So this, I think, is one of the biggest differences between just like the payment stuff with kids and adult classes. Is with adults, it seems like almost all classes are either pay per week, pay for the entire semester, or buy a punch card. But when I was looking into different like studio management software, almost everything was made with kids in mind, and it seemed like a monthly tuition payment was more common. So it sounds like that's what the scenario that you're talking about. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it would be a nightmare to have weekly. That would be really, because you need staff to handle payments. It's very difficult if you've got a bunch of, you know, think about, I guess it's hard to imagine if you haven't seen it, but you've got kids coming to be dropped off, kids coming, you know, or they're being picked up, and there's a lot of people, and you're trying to make payments, you know, trying to take payments and give receipts, and it gets really, really hectic. We have somebody that's at a desk in the front, and that's their job. That's their job to take payments and answer questions and hand out things, and that's their full-time job. So if you had to deal with, on a weekly basis, that kind of madhouse or trying to catch up with people who haven't paid, I think that would be a really, really difficult thing to do. Mm-hmm. And punch cards, that wouldn't work for kids at all.
They would lose them.
Because, yeah, well, no, not even that. It's that if they came that inconsistently, they'd never mm-hmm. learn anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that just wouldn't, I wouldn't have even thought of that. That is not something that would work at all with kids. Did you have any other questions, or did I answer everything?
Well, you did, but you know, another thing that I saw in the software that I was looking at was it also had really complicated features for doing things like giving discounts if multiple kids enroll in the school or if the kid is taking multiple classes.
Yeah,
do you have a sense,
I'm glad you brought that up.
Expected? Do parents expect that kind of thing from a dance school?
Well, I can only go from experience. I can't really say what other schools do. We give, and we call it a sister discount, but, you know, it's really for any family member. We do give a sister, what we call a sister discount, which is if you have one person, now that could be the parent, that could be the child, doesn't matter. The first person pays full tuition, and then we offer a $10 deduction for anyone else who's in that household. Any other family member in that household gets $10 off their tuition. And that for us, that's a very small amount of money because our classes are biweekly, so the tuition is substantial. That is that's a really small discount. It's really just a, hey, we appreciate you kind of discount. But yeah, we do offer a little family discount. Another thing that we offer, because we have mandatory fundraising, and we have added this again in the last 8 to 10 years because we realized there was a problem, we have lots and lots and lots of cousins. Tons of cousins. And so when it comes to fundraising, that becomes an issue because they're trying to sell to all the very same people. Mm. So we also offer again, in the big picture, it's not a big discount, but a little bit of a discount on fundraising if we have cousins that applies, or family members that are all related, that are, we know, you know, they're all in the same house or they're all in the same family, and we realize that fundraising is going to be an issue. So yeah, we do offer a discount for that. And what was the other thing? There was one other discount I think that you said.
There was one for the same student taking multiple classes.
Multiple classes. Okay, so we have recently broken into a new structure where it is not mandatory that they come 2 times a week. That used to be mandatory. They were required to take some sort of folk dance on one day, and the other day was ballet. But we had a lot of people in recent years that are not willing to do that. They only want hip-hop or ballet or whatever the very, very specific class that they want, and if they have to pay for anything else, they'll leave. So we offer the same discount for kids who are taking 2 different classes. Let's say they're taking Flick Lurico on one day, and the other day they're taking hip-hop. The second class, we offer a $10 discount.
Mm-hmm. And one other thing that you mentioned much earlier when we were talking about something else was a registration fee. Can you tell me about that? Because I've never heard of that for adult classes.
Oh, really? That's pretty common in my area. To be honest with you, that's really just a way of raising funds where I am anyway. It's kind of an administrative fee. We are very, very old school, and everything is like handwritten in a notebook or in a receipt book. So that's why it's very easy for us to waive that and use that as an incentive. Mm-hmm. But some studios, they have complicated, as you're talking about, these programs, and somebody has to spend the time to enter all that information into the computer and to make sure that everything is, you know, kind of filled out, checked off. They've signed their permission slips. They've signed whatever waivers. They understand, you know, they've gotten a student handbook on and on and on. And so if you're paying somebody to do those things, then that's a big administrative fee. And mm-hmm. so they are including the registration fee to kind of offset those expenses.
And is that something that you charge the first time somebody joins your school, or is it every year or every semester?
For us, we only that's a one-time fee, unless the child leaves for a very long period of time. If the child is gone for years, let's say the child danced with us until they were 5 or 6 and they left and now they're a teenager, then, yeah, we're definitely going to charge them a registration fee. But again, you can use that as an incentive. If you've got a teenager, like we've had teenagers that once they start hitting that preteen area, you've got a moody mess. And so if you've got a kid that's pouting because mom is making them come back to class and that parent is having to fight with the kid, if you go, hey, you know, let me just waive your registration fee, even though that might be nothing to you, it shows the parent that you appreciate them and that you understand.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there are so many more things I could ask you, but we've been at this for 90 minutes. Can you believe it?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I knew it was going to be a lot. I knew it was going to be a lot.
Yeah.
There's so many things we didn't talk about. Yeah.
There are.
There's just one thing I want to say, really, I want to interject this because it's just so much a part of the reason that I teach. And that is, I want to share with everyone that I'm no spring chicken. I've been around for a long time, and at this point, I have seen not only for one thing, I've worn a lot of hats. I was a child dancer, then I was a parent. I've done the administrative end of it, and then I was an instructor. I've been a board member. I've kind of been the whole gamut. So I really, really have been exposed to these kids, even if they weren't my students. I've gotten to know these kids, and I have been around long enough that I've seen both like kids that kind of are close to my daughter's age when they start, you know, becoming older teens and young women, and plus then now the little sisters of those kids, and now a next bracket up from that. And when they start becoming young women, if they grew up dancing, wow, you start to really see how all that training spills over into other aspects of their lives. And they are very, very good at presenting themselves and handling pressure and being tenacious and overcoming disappointment. All those things really start to manifest themselves when they become young adults. I personally know that that is where those things came from, because I witnessed them being groomed into those kids in the classroom. And so to see that is just so awesome and awe-inspiring, because they become these lovely, honorable young women. And I feel very, very honored to be a part of that. So that is, I really wanted to share that with people and let people know how, when you kind of look at the big picture of why am I doing this, that is something that you should really take into account.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. All right. Well, we're going to open it up to questions and answers for Treasure in just a minute. But before we do that, Treasure, if people want to learn more from you, whether it's this topic or other topics, what's the best way for them to do that?
I do have a website, as you know, I'm an instructor with the Belly Dance Business Academy, and I have a course on teaching kids where I go really into depth about some of the things that we've talked about. I also cover things like structuring choreography, I tried to include a lot of things that I think get overlooked, like what kind of space you need, what kind of information you need to put in your student handbook, what kinds of things you need to tell parents, how to fill them out when they first come in. kind of find out what kind of classes they're looking for. So I have several classes at the Belly Dance Business Academy. I'm going to have another one coming out in August. My other classes are costume related. And I have, of course, my DVD and all of those classes that are available now on the Belly Dance Business Academy. They should be digital products available on Amazon by this fall.
Nice. All right. So we'll include links to all of those in the show notes. So if anybody is listening to that, we'll send that out for you soon. But now it's time to open up for questions and answers. So if you're listening on the webcast, you should see a little icon over on the right side of the screen that looks like a square speech bubble. Or if you're listening on phone or Skype, you can press ** to unmute yourself. We would love to hear any questions you have or your favorite takeaway from the call or the most surprising thing that you heard. This is the part where we wait for the first person to be brave.
I really invite your questions. I really, really do. I would love to know why very few belly dance teachers teach kids, and I would love to hear your questions and concerns about that.
Nobody yet. Well, I think when it comes to not teaching kids, I think so much of it is that none of us had that modeled for us. So many of us start as adults that we don't really have a baseline for how you would teach that to kids because we never saw it done.
Yeah, that's probably true, which is sad.
It is, yeah.
So be that person. You can be that person that made that available so that some child grew up with that in their life.
Absolutely. So it looks like we've got Irene. Hi there.
Oh, I did it. I couldn't figure out how to. I'm new to this. I live in a community. It's very prim and proper. And I had tried to teach once in the rec center, just adults, and I assumed I'd include kids too, but the board got together and they go, oh no, nobody under 18. That was several years ago. And I really want to teach.
The rec center?
What?
I'm so sorry. I just wanted to clarify. The board that was involved in running the rec center, is that who we're talking about?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But
I'm sorry.
I think maybe, I just need to approach them a little differently, and this is several years later, and maybe they're more open to it now, but I'd like to try again. Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, I would say do a lot of prep work. I would say really think about what you want to say and how you want to say it, because the language that you use can be really critical in how people view it. And I've gotten to be real practiced at that. But sometimes even with me, no matter how hard I try, you can get off on the wrong foot with people. But I would say really do a lot of prep. Think about how you're going to dress. Think about what you want to say. Think about what did they give any objections particularly? Was there
what?
A reason why they didn't? What did they have? Did they give you any? Like, did they tell you what their objections were to
just to run under it? Girls. I don't think they really know much about belly dancing, but they thought it was inappropriate.
Gotcha. Okay, so then we're back to that word that people have trouble with, the words belly dance.
Yeah.
I would call it something else. I definitely, and it doesn't have to be. I use folk dance because I am a folk dancer. I teach Mexican and Spanish dance. But you don't have to use that word. Somebody that's really clever could probably think of some other terminology that would make it look or make it sound more pleasing, I would point that out. I would be open. When you go back, I would say, I'd be real open. I would say, you know, hey, I really wanted to do this, and I tried to start this up a few years ago, and there were a lot of objections, and I'm not really sure why. So, this is what I want to do, and, you know, if do you have any of, you know, if they have objections, then you can say, or say something on the, along the lines of, hey, what are your objections about this? Because let me change it if I need to, or let me clear that up for you if it's a misunderstanding. And I think that you might have a better reception.
Mm, yeah.
One thing that I always think about when I'm, you know, kind of scrolling through my YouTube feed is that so often you see like videos from Middle Eastern weddings where you get like all the little girls social dancing in with their families. And I wonder if like bringing them a video of like, see, this is what it's about might help.
Yeah.
I think that might work. I would choose carefully.
Absolutely. Cool. Well, that's a great question.
Do you have any other questions? Yeah. Okay. Good. Yay.
All right. Thanks, Irit.
Okay.
All right. And if there's anybody else who would like to ask a question or share their favorite takeaway, you can press ** to unmute yourself. All right. Well, we're already running over time, so I think I'm going to call it instead of giving everybody a few more minutes to get brave. So okay. Thank you so much, Treasure.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, that was fantastic. All right. And thank you, everybody, for coming. This is the end of our call, but that doesn't mean that the conversation has to end. We've got a private Facebook group just for Clubhouse members, and I'll send a link out shortly with an invitation to that. As always, there is a delay between when you ask to join and when we approve you, just to make sure that it's only belly dancers and not creepy looky-loos. And in that email, I'll also include a link to the call recording, to the resources that Treasure mentioned, and also a link to our feedback survey. So if you'd like to suggest a topic or a speaker or any other way that we can improve this, we would love to hear about that. Our next call is going to be on Thursday, August 24th, and my guest Farha is going to be talking about how to take charge of your own development. So if you're learning without a teacher, or if your teacher doesn't have a clear plan for you, this can help you figure out how to kind of chart your own course. Letting you know what's going on in the belly dance geek world is I have started a brand new audio podcast series that I have been recording during my morning coffee runs. So the Clubhouse calls are once a month, and they're these big, you know, hour, 90-minute long calls, and these are much shorter things, a little like 3, 5, 6 minute, almost like audio articles. So if you've been getting the Clubhouse call invitations by email, you'll get a monthly digest of those starting in about 2 weeks, but you can also find the ones that I've published already at bellydancegeek.com. If you're not getting those Clubhouse call emails, you'll want to sign up to get those. So you can go to bellydancegeek.com, and there's just a sign up form in the right sidebar. And the last thing that I want to say is that this is the come on in kind of Clubhouse, not the no boys allowed kind. So if you know anybody who would like to join us, you can invite them to do that at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.